Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is Side 1 of For the Record Program Number 545, Update on 9/11 and Related Matters. This program is being recorded on March 19th of the year 2006. And we're going to begin by taking a look at some interesting Saudi economic and political operations inside of Lebanon. And specifically, we're going to take a look at the tremendous amount of wealth that the petrodollar-rich Saudis have invested in Lebanon, both in its economic infrastructure and, by extension, in the mainspring of Lebanese political life as well. One of the major developments in recent months in Lebanon has been the bomb assassination of Rafik Hariri, the former Lebanese prime minister. We're going to be taking a look at Mr. Hariri, and we're going to be taking a look in particular at some of the complexities surrounding Rafik Hariri as a political animal. I think that the information being presented here will help, I think, an observer to begin asking at least some of the right questions and would lead an investigator to begin going down some of the right paths. But I think at the same time that the information being presented here in some ways will raise more questions than it will answer. However, I think as we take a look at the Saudi economic slash political role in Lebanon, and in turn, as we examine the extent to which Rafik Hariri he's dead now, unfortunately, but he was a creature of that, then I think it is going to indicate to us just how treacherous the waters he plied actually were. And I think in terms of who actually sort of might have done the deed, there are a lot of possibilities, and I think a lot of possibilities for confused conspiratorialism, because indeed the late Rafik Hariri existed in some extremely perilous waters. Lebanon itself could be said to be extremely perilous waters. And as we'll see, Hariri himself was not only part of the Saudi economic investment milieu in Lebanon, but also through that had come to be associated in some ways with Islamist elements, including those directly connected to Al-Qaeda and other terrorist elements. Now, this is not necessarily to imply that he was a terrorist or an active supporter of them, but rather to indicate that in the environment of which he was part, then the terrorist milieu is part of that economic environment. Indeed, underlying the events of 9/11, perhaps more than anything else, is money. And we're going to be taking a look in considerable measure at the role of money in not only the creating the mechanisms that led to this, but also in motivating people to cover things up. Now, we're going to begin by reading a fair amount from a book that we've used many times in the past. The book is called Dollars for Terror. It was subtitled The United States and Islam. It was authored by Richard LaBaviere, published in English in softcover by Algora Press, copyright 2000, before September 11th. In this book, there is a considerable discussion of just how Saudi Arabia executes its foreign policy. And to make a very, very long story very, very short, it does so with money. It does so because it has a lot of money. It also has the holy places of Mecca within its borders. And the Saudis, for all of their incredible corruption and in many cases fascism, they are very, very intelligent and very judicious in terms of the way they use their tremendous power. They are not in any way to be underestimated. In a chapter called Why Saudi Arabia Finances Islamism, author LaBaviere writes as follows about the relationship between Syria and Lebanon. Now, bear in mind that the Syrian Ba'ath Party and the Syrian government and the military wielded tremendous and still wield tremendous influence in Lebanon, which had actually been part of Syria up until the early part of the last century. We should note here that one of the things that the Saudis have done is to successfully marry off a member of the royal family, specifically a wife of Crown Prince, now King Abdullah, to a sister of Rifat al-Assad. So basically the ruling family of Syria is married into the royal family of Saudi Arabia. Diplomatic/political connections like that and some of the economic connections we're about to describe, including those embracing the career of the late Rafiq Hariri, are one of the things that gives Saudi Arabia a tremendous amount of influence in Syria, and in turn, with by virtue of their influence in Syria and also Lebanon and Egypt, the Saudis are able to manipulate Arab policy vis-a-vis Israel. Then Richard LaBavier writes as follows in Dollars for Terror. Of the relationship between Saudi Arabia and Syria, he says, "Everything augurs well for future relations with Damascus, since one of the designated crown prince's wives, Hassa al-Shalan, is Syrian and, what is more, sister of the wife of Rifat al-Assad, the brother of the Syrian president, who is thus the brother-in-law of the next king of Arabia. These family and tribal relations can only consolidate a Riyadh-Damascus axis." Then skipping down. "In fact," a former French ambassador to Riyadh summarizes, quoting again, "Saudi Arabia forms with Egypt and Syria a self-sufficient, quote, decision-making triangle, unquote, for everything that generally relates to shaping the Arab attitude with respect to the Palestinian question. It is an undeniable success of the Saud's Arab diplomacy. Indeed, it is traditionally admitted that no war against Israel is possible without Egypt, and no peace without Syria. In spite of its significant funding capacity, Saudi Arabia, a giant banker but a dwarf soldier, is in no position to be a major actor in the Israeli-Palestinian process. But in this, quote, decision-making triangle, unquote, with Egypt and Syria, it is placed on an equal footing with two Arab partners that are strategically much greater than itself." And next, LaBavier goes on to describe how this applies to Saudi economic and political policy in Lebanon, and how, in turn, in particular, the late Rafiq Hariri, was an integral part of that presence. In Dollars for Terror, LaBavier writes, "Lebanon is emblematic of the immense Saudi capacities of financing and is tactically key for Saudi sponsorship of Islamist movements. Having little strategic importance, even though it is on the front line vis-à-vis Israel, Lebanon indeed arouses Riyadh's interest completely out of proportion to its weight on the regional scene. All the great Saudi families are economically omnipresent in Beirut, and Riyadh regularly supports the exchange rate of the Lebanese currency. The principal pan-Arab newspapers, initially Lebanese, are controlled by Saudi finance. The Lebanese former Prime Minister Rafiq Hariri himself owes a good share of his personal fortune to the royal family of Saudi Arabia, which conceded to him a quasi-monopoly over the construction and maintenance of innumerable princely palaces as well as major public works projects. Furthermore, he, parenthetically Hariri, holds a Saudi passport, thus making an exception to the rule that formally precludes dual citizenship with Saudi Arabia." By the way, I was reading a portion of the book, interjecting here, the book Sleeping with the Devil by Robert Baer, a former CIA officer, and he was discussing the fact that on Saudi passports it is made quite explicit that the bearer is a property, is actually literally the property of the Saudi royal family. So that would have applied in a technical sense to the late Rafiq Hariri. Now, what precisely that means in terms of the possible author of his murder, I do not know. We're going to ruminate about that later. But as I said at the beginning, in my introduction, I think in many ways the material here, although I think it helped direct that investigation in an informed sense, raises more questions than it answers. Continuing, of the Saudi economic/political presence in Lebanon. "Having become one of the principal financial outposts of the kingdom, Lebanon is located at the crossroads of the Saud's Arab and Muslim diplomacies. In Lebanon, a Saudi financial protectorate, all the underwriters and the beneficiaries of Saudi generosity," unquote, meet. To counter the pro-Iranian Hezbollah engaged against Israel in southern Lebanon, but now represented in the Lebanese parliament, The Saudis employ the same recipe they apply everywhere else. They use money. This is a perilous approach, however, because the benefit is not always proportional to the cost. Thus, it sometimes happens that Islamist factions financed by the Saudis turn against their benefactors. Well, one of the things that we're going to look at next is just how complicated some of this can be, because indeed, wherever you find great amounts of money, you are going to be finding an awful lot of very hungry and potentially or and actually deadly elements. And among those elements are criminal elements, both semi-official government-related elements and criminal elements that are rooted more in economic hunger, so to speak, and more in the lower realms of the vice world. Not inconsiderable, but not necessarily connected in an overt sense with the state. There is an entire chapter in the book Dollars for Terror by La Bevière called Islamist Deal-Making and Organized Crime. And it talks about exactly that. It talks about how some of the Islamist terror milieu, plural, around the world, how some of the various organizations have been able to derive considerable amounts of income from various organized criminal activities, drug dealing being a major one of those, also the smuggling of precious stones, weapons trafficking, and various other forms of organized criminal activity. One of the areas where various types of organized crime, including drug and weapon smuggling and various forms of counterfeiting, have hooked up in a big way not only with Islamist terrorism, but also, as we saw in For the Record 357 among other, or excuse me, For the Record 457 among other programs, with neo-Nazi elements that were part of September 11th. Indeed, the December 2002 issue of Vanity Fair has an article by Sebastian Junger in which he identifies a former Vietnam veteran and former Green Beret as not only someone who trained Islamist terrorists in the Three Corners area that we're about to examine, but who also provided logistical assistance to Mohammed Atta in the United States on September 11th. The Three Corners area is a portion of Latin America where Argentina, Brazil, and Paraguay all meet. It offers a number of advantages. First of all, if somebody is, if the heat comes down in one of those countries, you scoot across the border and you're in another country. It makes a number of various kinds of illegal activities convenient, and for that reason it's become something, pardon my French, of a mecca for various types of criminal elements, including Islamist terrorists. What we're going to do now is to take a look at the Three Corners area and its role in the world's criminal syndicates, and also how Rafiq Hariri, with at least some al-Qaeda operatives in his personal retinue, fits into this picture. And here again, I think we'll begin to see, bearing in mind that Rafiq Hariri, the late Rafiq Hariri, was a Saudi economic political presence in Lebanon, the circumstances surrounding his death become this much more complicated as we take a look at sort of another level of treacherous individuals or another level of treacherous connections that were attendant upon the late Rafiq Hariri. Certainly the possibilities as to who could have been used at the operational level to kill him and who could have authored such a deed, I think, grow, if anything, more numerous proceeding into this investigation. Of the Three Corners area, Richard LaBavier writes, "Once an obligatory way station for war criminals and other fleeing Nazis, the region known as the Three Borders, Brazil, Argentina, and Paraguay, is considered by anti-terrorist experts to be a new base of radical Islamism. Often, intelligence agencies have traced the leaders of Hezbollah, Hamas, and the International Organization of the Muslim Brotherhood to this area, forming a triangle between the towns of Puerto Iguazu, Argentina, Foz do Iguaçu in Brazil, and Ciudad del Este in Paraguay. The area holds a population of more than 400,000, a quarter of them foreigners, with strong Near Eastern communities, especially Lebanese. At the center, the site of the marvelous waterfalls of Iguaçu hosts more than 40,000 visitors a year, which makes the identification and the monitoring of people particularly difficult. In addition, the topography, crisscrossed by innumerable rivers and streams, makes it impossible to get an overall view. This tormented physical and human geography encourages all sorts of traffic. Ciudad del Este has thus become the Latin American capital for counterfeiting and for the smuggling of weapons and explosives. Weapons come from the United States via Paraguay and are mainly destined for the markets of Rio de Janeiro and São Paulo. They follow the route to Foz do Iguaçu and cross the border of Paraguay at Mato Grosso do Sul. Small landing strips in the region are also used for delivering cargoes and drugs. A non-producing country, Brazil is today the main regional transit center for the cocaine trade from Colombia and Bolivia, heading for the United States and Europe via Cape Verde, the Ivory Coast, and South Africa. Experts estimate that 80% of Colombian cocaine passes through the Islamic Latin American triangle. The Latin American, Chinese, and Near Eastern mafias have made their headquarters there. The Mosque of Foz do Iguaçu, which also has a Quran school, regularly receives visits by religious dignitaries and Saudi businessmen, although the communities are mainly Shiite. In 1997, the Lebanese former Prime Minister Rafik Hariri was the honorary guest of the Arab community of Ciudad del Este. Accompanied by a delegation of Gulf financiers, he was mainly interested in Near Eastern investments in the region. At the time, the police services identified a close collaborator of Osama bin Laden in his retinue. Now, this next passage deals specifically with Rafik Hariri, who, as indicated above, had the presence of at least one Osama bin Laden aide in his retinue when he visited the Three Corners area. Next, Labavir goes on to ruminate about Hariri and how many of these types of connections really are more complicating than simplifying in terms of the investigation. But certainly, I think, in terms of asking who might have killed Rafik Hariri, there are a number of interesting possibilities. I would not want to have been the company that held his life insurance policy. Returning to the text. Certainly, the Lebanese former prime minister is not considered to be a dangerous terrorist himself, but his many business engagements often lead him to mingle with intermediaries who are directly involved in Islamist mafia operations that generate international terrorism. The Lebanese cauldron, unquote, alone deserves a close investigation into the gray areas of finance where private banking, international businessmen, and major offshore criminals meet. Whether in Latin America or Beirut, these business milieu reveal the osmosis that is going on between the criminal hierarchies and the legal structures of economic and financial activity worldwide. It is symptomatic that when one finds the heads of various criminal groups, one reaches the limit of the criminal activity at the same time. The influence of the various mafias is never so great and so dangerous as when they leverage their criminal activities to ply all the levers that legal society offers in order to subvert that legality itself. Money laundering is not only a monetary activity aiming to legalize dirty money by injecting it into illicit economic sectors, it is also exerted on organizations and elite groups that also wish to be made respectable. Quote, "One point is essential. Organized crime is not only a problem of criminality anymore. It is too broad a topic these days to be entrusted solely to the criminologists. The economy of crime was based in the legal economy. If you make a clean distinction between organized crime and the sphere of finance, you are condemned to not understand either one. Certainly, it is more comfortable to regard the mafias and the criminal organizations as malevolent foreign powers. Reality is less appealing and more complex. Criminality has become an essential gear in the engine of contemporary societies." So indeed, who might have killed Rafik Hariri? I think there are a lot of possibilities. Certainly, as someone who was a creature of the Saudis, anyone who might have thought about opposing Saudi policy in Lebanon might have been a possible author of the killing of Rafik Hariri. That might have been the Syrians, perhaps somebody else. It's within the realm of possibility that somebody who was ostensibly a supporter of his might have set him up as some sort of provocation. Who knows? Certainly, as indicated there, the world of, quote, legitimate, unquote, finance surrounding Rafiq Hariri merged seamlessly into an underworld which has a very strong relationship with the overworld and which breeds not only organized criminal activity but related Islamist terrorist activity, feeding off of some of the criminal activity in order to sustain itself. Indeed, in the background, actually not really the background, but in the foreground of many of the things that have been the focal point of charges made by Sibel Edmonds, an FBI translator and well-known whistleblower, Sibel Edmonds has claimed that criminal activity, including drug smuggling that's connected to terrorist activity, has penetrated official Washington and sort of has officialdom there penetrated and seriously compromised. And specifically, she cited Turkish-connected drug smuggling operations that were very, very well connected indeed. It is that type of relationship and that type of milieu singular that Rafiq Hariri was a part of. Indeed, the Turkish drug connection goes through Lebanon. So who killed Rafiq Hariri and why? There are a number of people who might very well have done it. Certainly, there was no shortage of people around him. But in assessing Hariri as a political entity, note that he was a Saudi creature and had all of the various characteristics of a major Saudi investment, including some of the bin Laden milieu. As to who killed him, you tell me. What we're going to take a look at next concerns an article that really one, the existence of which could have been fairly logically deduced. In a number of broadcasts, we have spoken of the chilling forecast made in 1998 in a restaurant in Lower Manhattan, specifically the Tribeca Grill. And this was a prediction that was made by a guy named R.G. Abbas, not only a weapons dealer, but someone working for the Pakistani intelligence service. And pointing to the Twin Towers, he said, in the presence of Randy Glass, a wired FBI informant, in other words, wired to record the conversation in which he was engaged, R.G. Abbas, Pakistani intelligence agent, pointed to the Twin Towers and said, "See those two towers? They're coming down." And an article in the India Telegraph, basically, of Calcutta this past week talked about an active Pakistani diplomatic effort to cover up the Pakistani involvement in September 11th. This is from the India Telegraph of Calcutta from Monday, March 13th of 2006. It's Dateline New Delhi on March 12th. Pakistan Weekly spills 9/11 beans, and it's from their special correspondent. It reads, "The Pakistan Foreign Office had paid tens of thousands of dollars to lobbyists in the U.S. to get anti-Pakistan references dropped from the 9/11 Inquiry Commission report, The Friday Times has claimed. The Pakistani Weekly said its story is based on disclosures made by Foreign Service officials to the Public Accounts Committee at a secret meeting in Islamabad on Tuesday. It claimed that some of the commission members were also bribed to prevent them from including damaging information about Pakistan. The magazine said that the PAC grilled officials in the presence of Foreign Secretary Riaz Mohammad Khan and Special Secretary Shur Afghan on the money paid to lobbyists. Quote, "The disclosure sheds doubt on the integrity and honesty of the members of the 9/11 Inquiry Commission, and, above all, the authenticity of the information in their final report," it said. The report quoted an officer as saying that dramatic changes were made in the final draft of the Inquiry Commission after the lobbyists got to work. The panel was formed to probe the September 11th terror attack and make suggestions to fight terrorism. After the commission tipped the lobbyists about the damaging revelations on Pakistan's role in 9/11, they contacted the panel members and asked them to go soft on the country. The Friday Times claimed that a lot of money was used to... The Friday Times claimed that a lot of money was used to silence these members. According to the report, the lobbyists also helped Pakistan win the sympathy of 75 U.S. congressmen as part of its strategy to guard Islamabad's interests in Washington. Quote, U.S. softened towards Pakistan only because of the efforts of the Foreign Office, one official was quoted as saying in the report. The Pakistan Foreign Office defended the decision to hire the lobbyists, saying it was an established practice in the United States. An observer at the Islamabad meeting said the money could play an important role in buying powerful people. The remark came in response to comments made by some U.S. officials after 9/11 that, quote, Pakistanis will sell their mothers for a dollar, unquote. Pakistan had emerged as a front-runner in the fight against terrorism unleashed by the U.S. after the terror strikes. Washington pumped in billions of dollars to win President Pervez Musharraf's support in launching a crackdown on the al-Qaeda network thriving on the Pakistan-Afghanistan border. And inside two of the program, we're going to take a look at some information that we first covered in For the Record program number 500. We're going to take a look at the chilling forecast, the accurate forecast, made by Pakistani intelligence agent R.G. Abbas in 1998. And to give you an idea of what it is that the Pakistanis and their American bribees, to coin a term, were trying to hide, we're going to read a little information that we're going to recap on side two. We heard this in For the Record number 500. This is from Sander Hicks' book, The Big Wedding. Glass here is Randy Glass, an FBI informant who was wired for sound for this particular meeting. Excuse me, this was in June of 1999, not 1998. From The Big Wedding, at a dinner in June of 1999 at the Tribeca Grill, Glass was wining and dining Rudum G. Abbas, a Pakistani arms dealer, and his friends. Glass and ATF agent Dick Stoltz were posing as weapons brokers as part of a federal sting operation. The Pakistani had close connections to the Pakistani intelligence elite, the ISI. In fact, Glass later told Dateline he believed Abbas was an ISI agent. The Tony Tribeca Grill, owned by Robert De Niro, was just north of the World Trade Center in 1999. Abbas boasted to his dinner companions that he wouldn't have any problem taking out the entire downtown restaurant, quote, because it's full of Americans, unquote. Towards the end of the meal, he gestured out towards the Twin Towers. Those towers are coming down, unquote. And that in 1999. So we're going to talk about that more on side two. It certainly appears the Pakistanis had a fair amount to cover up. However, that will be on side two. Speaking of For the Record 500, all of the For the Record shows are being archived by sister station WFMU. Programs streaming at www.wfmu.org/Dave Emery. Older shows available for download only at a linked URL. The Spitfire website also features For the Record shows for download on real audio or MP3. It also features lectures available on file, books, long article-length descriptions of the various For the Record shows, and links to other websites with a wealth of information. Go to www.spitfirelist.com and wander through the forest of information that's available on that website and on linked websites. And if you don't like what you're hearing about here, if this information disturbs you, there's also a page to click on to support the work that I'm doing. And if you don't like what's going on, there's no better way to resist it than to support the work that I'm doing. This concludes side one of For the Record program number 545, update on 9/11 and related matters. This is being recorded on March 19th of 2005. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.